We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't take our trips on LSD.
Oh, baby. Well, folks, Brian White has charted 17 singles on Billboard's country charts, had 6 number one singles, 2 platinum records, 2 gold records. He joined forces with some girl named Shania something or other, and together they took From This Moment On all the way up to number 4 in the Billboard's Hot 100 chart with Casey Kasem. He's garnered several awards. That was the worst, Casey. I don't know what that was.
Dear Casey.
He's garnered several awards for himself, including a Grammy, a CMA Horizon Award, an ACM Top Male Vocalist Award among them. Blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on and on. Basically, he is, what do they call him? People Magazine's one of their 50 most beautiful people. He is the Rob Lowe of country music.
Oh, my God.
There you go. How you doing, man?
I'm great, man. I'm good. Good to talk to you guys.
So listen, my first question for you is your grandmother, I mean, was she really a national square dance caller back in the 40s and 50s?
My great-grandmother was, yeah.
Man, that is the cool, my dad has been known to call a dance every once in a while, and so when I found that out, you just became a hero of mine.
Oh man, well that's cool, that's awesome, I love all that stuff.
Well, of course, growing up in a musical family in Oklahoma City, the bigger question is, have you or any of your family ever been in the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, Oklahoma?
Not that I know of, but you know what? If somebody called me today, I would totally be stoked. I would totally do it.
Which part would you do? That drunk, crazy guy they all thought killed somebody?
Exactly. Yeah. No. I'd do Curly if I had the opportunity. I'd totally do the Curly part.
Okay. So who was the guy who stalled your career as Buddy Rich, the drummer? Somebody hijacked your drumming career and turned you on to guitar.
I moved to town, kind of. You know, my first instrument is drums, and I kind of moved to town with that being sort of my ace in the hole. You know, and the singing thing, I sang, but you know, I was a little bit more insecure about that. You know, I wasn't sure, where that was going to, you know, go. And you know, as fate would have it, it ended up going that direction more. And, you know, I got better at it and became an artist, you know. But I don't know, along the way, I guess I came to town and was playing on some different things and I guess I just sort of got encouraged a little bit more the other direction from everybody around me.
Well, I heard you say in an interview that it's hard to write songs as a drummer. Brian, have you ever actually written a song as a drummer?
Well, I think the drummer is always a subconscious. He's the subconscious drummer is always chiming in somewhere in a song, but that I'm writing. But yeah, I think I've said that just because you know. There's no music, you know, it's all, you know, percussion. So I had to learn how to play guitar, you know, and some other things in order to really help me melodically know where to go, you know,
All right. So, just take us back to this day, right? You're leaving Phoenix, you're headed to Tucson on a radio tour and you heard your song on the radio, right? And you actually stopped and called the station from a payphone and told them, hey, this is Brian White. Just wanted to thank you guys for playing my song. I really appreciate it. Did you really do that?
I really did that, yeah. You know, there weren't any cell phones. There were then, but, you know, it was, like, super expensive if you had one. You were doing pretty good if you had one of those gigantic, you know, Motorola analog phones.
Yeah. Speaking of those gigantic Motorola analog phones, that was the phone you called your woman on. You know, the first time after you lost her number twice.
Man, you're good. You've really done some serious homework. I'm impressed. We had a phone on the bus, and we didn't use it unless it was like an emergency or a radio interview or something. You know, something like what we're doing right now. You know, and I took the liberty of calling her one night, and at the urging of one of my good friends, and. We just kind of hit it off, and you know, I asked her out on a date. The next time I came to, you know, L.A., and and the rest is history. I got the guitar out, and it was over with, I guess, you know.
was that the McPherson that won her over, or were you playing something different back then?
I was probably playing Takamine's then. I don't even think they had started building McPherson's at that time. Yeah.
Dude, I heard you playing that, and I don't know if you know this guy or not, but I heard similarities in your playing style to a buddy of mine named Tommy Emmanuel. You are some kind of player.
Oh, you please don't even mention me in the same sentence with that guy.
I didn't say you were as good as he is. I said I heard similarities.
Okay, good. Well, let's keep it at that because I can't even wear his shoes, man. He's a freak of nature. He's from another. He's got to be from Mars or something.
Australia, same thing. Yeah, he's good. He and I first met. I used to live in Australia, and we met down there, 100 years ago, and he's been on the show a few times. I remember he played in studio here, and the owner of the station knew him, so he came in and watched, and then the owner went home and threw out his guitar.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
Okay, so where'd you go? What happened? Why'd you disappear? How long were you in prison?
Not too long. I got out pretty fast. No, I'm kidding. You know, it's a long one, and I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. The end of the 90s, I didn't have a real strong character when I was younger. I was one of those guys that I just sort of let the machine run me, and I wasn't real good at standing up for myself and saying no. No, I don't want to do that. I want to take a break, all I knew then was just to keep working, and it really ran me in the ground, and it kind of sent me into a little bit of a tailspin. I got really burnt out on music and kind of the whole thing, just because I allowed myself to, work that hard and just kind of do. I forgot that everybody else was working for me and not me for them. Nobody ever told me that. So it messed me up for a while. I kind of stepped away from the business to sort of regroup and recharge and realize that I was still alive and so I started dreaming again. I got excited about life again and got married in 2000 and we started having kids and music started becoming real to me again. And
good.
And that was it. That was it. Kind of the machine I got ran in the ground and got really burnt out and had to step away from it. I kind of got a little depressed for a while and really needed to step out of that whole scenario and heal myself. And I feel like I'm still healing, So
a little birdie told me that Erica saved your scrawny butt. True story?
Big part of it, yes. Yeah. Big part of it, for sure.
By the way, this is what inquiring minds really want to know. When you first met Erica, by the way, soap opera star extraordinaire, at that cystic fibrosis event down in L.A., what were those dumb things that you said? Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember one of them in particular. And I'm notorious for saying dumb things and incorrect material. just anything that I could possibly say that's wrong, I will say it. So far on this show, I don't think I've done it yet, but there's a good chance.
Wait for it.
Yeah. I was in the stairwell. She was going... she was leaving, and we were both kind of departing, and we saw each other in the stairwell after we had met. I said, "Hey, it was nice meeting you," and I said, "I really love Party of Five, and she was never on that show, It was a different show. Actually, the show called Second Noah that at the time was kind of a network rival, And she corrected me. She said, no, it's called Second Noah. And at that moment, I knew my chance was over. That was it. I thought this girl will never go out with me because I've already screwed up the title of her show. She's going to think I'm a moron,
Yeah. So. Nice one. So not the smoothest cat in the world. I can relate a little bit. I remember when I was 19, I actually said to a girl, for a fat girl, you don't sweat much.
Oh my God. Well, I don't feel so bad now.
All right. So, how long until you and the little lady and the two kids? How long till you guys get a piece of land out near Leaper's Fork, right, and cowboy up those two boys of yours?
Well, as a matter of fact, we're kind of looking around outside of Nashville as we speak. There's a good chance, yeah, because I'm from Oklahoma, so I'm a cowboy at heart. So, you know, and I love being outdoors and all that stuff. So
cool.
So we're working on it.
All right. All right. Good. Do they still have the General Lee parked at that little country store, Leaper's Fork?
Last time I was there, they did.
Yeah. That was a cool little spot. Actually, last time I was there, this is brutal. I don't think I should share this, but I'm going to. I phoned up a realtor and said, I'm here representing some clients from Toronto. Yes, I lied. And I'm looking for properties between 1.8 and 2.6. Can you show me some? What a jerk.
Hey, we've all done that, man.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes, we have. Hey, so you got the two boys, Justin and Jackson. Did Jack run out of school on the last day when the bell rang and scream freedom like William Wallace?
He said he did it when he walked out of the school, and then when he got off the bus, he walked out into the grass and kissed the ground and said it again, screamed freedom. So
oh, I love that.
I'm raising him right, man.
Yeah. I remember burning my backpack with all the books inside of it. Just set it on fire in the schoolyard. Just left it there. Maybe just suggest that to him.
That's funny.
Okay, so what exactly does a producer do? Because I know you're not just the singer, songwriter guy. I mean, you're a producer extraordinaire. Because I think I can be a producer, but I need to know what they do first.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, you're trying to take what an artist does and you know, enhance it, prop it up, make it bigger and better, and help them find or write the best songs they can, help them. To you know, have a good vision, help them to sort of materialize their vision, you know, musically where they want to go, and that entails, you know, editing and coaching them with their vocals in the vocal booth you know, parts and, you know, different treatments. You know, does this need strings? What kind of arrangement, you know, does this song need? You know, kind of all of those things, you know, kind of being a coach in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because when I mean, even my son and I used to drive him to volleyball practice, you know, every day of the week, and it was an hour drive, and we would just literally tear apart songs and say, boy, I could use a fiddle right there in that section there, or that could use, you know, a little blues harp here, or, I don't know, whatever. So I think I can do what you do easily.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know what? I have no doubt.
What does overproducing look like? I mean, I know to you, overproducing looks like you having to shut down your career for a while. But can you know when someone says, "Oh, that's overproduced"? What does that mean?
Well, it means they should have walked away from the mirror and quit fixing their hair. You know,
yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
you know, it. Well, in my opinion, I think there's a lot of that going on in my town. I think people don't know when to stop. It's, you know, you can kind of tell it when there's, you know, there's probably over 120, 30 virtual tracks rolling at the same time.
Wow.
Getting squashed. And, they're, you know, at the end of the day, all the stuff they put on there, half of it you can't hear, you know, because there's so much stuff going on. And then, oh, by the way, you have to, you know, EQ a vocal enough to make it cut through all that bed of nonsense, you know. So...
Yeah, I mean,
hey, that's just me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Same deal.
If overproducing is your thing and you're having success at it, knock yourself out. You know?
Okay, so we've got this new album called Shine, due to drop on June 10th, I think. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Is the song you performed at Minnie McCready's funeral on this album?
Yes, it is.
Dude, you are going to wreck people with that song. That is just, man.
Were you there?
No.
Well, what? How do you know the song then?
Because, you know, I've got sources. It's the same way I know all, you know, come on, is this creeping you out a little bit? Sorry about that.
Yeah, I've kind of been a little shocked along the way.
Well, I think the first person who's going to buy that CD is Brené Brown, because it sounds like this whole album is going to be something that she would dig totally. I mean, this is a You Need to Be Authentic album, is it not?
Wow. I'm really starting to get creeped out now. you're reading my mail here. I mean, it's an incredibly autobiographical tune, you know. I mean, it's exactly how I feel right now, you know? Hmm. So I hope that record of it, you know, I hope the whole thing, you know, helps people. I hope people find I hope they can relate to it and that it helps them through whatever they're dealing with, you know? Hmm.
Well, Steve Warner, Vince Gill, Stevie Wonder, Michael McDonald, Merle Haggard, Ronnie Millsap, Max Carl, Glenn Campbell, if you could only listen to one of them when you're locked up in Folsom Prison for the rest of your life, who would it be? One.
Oh, it'd be Steve Warner.
You really are a junkie for him, aren't you?
Yeah, man, Steve's my hero, man. He's as good as they come.
Hmm.
Consistent, too, man. Just everything he does is awesome.
What's the Glenn Campbell connection?
When I first moved to Nashville, I was the first publishing deal that I was ever signed to was Glenn's company. Glenn Campbell Music signed me when I was 19 years old.
Man, you've had success right from the get-go, and for the rest of us schmucks who've had to suffer more than you, you know, we hate you for that. But do you think...
Well, my suffering came much later. So.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. That's the segue into this deal because, you know, I don't know all that went down and nor do I really care, but I do know that when I am forced to eat dirt a little bit in my life, that is the time, oddly enough, that I tend to look upwards and go, okay, God. I don't know. Did that happen to you?
Sure. All the time.
Because in Nashville, you know, you guys... eat, breathe, drink, sleep, God stuff, right? I mean, it's just everywhere. And I mean, you know, it's got to be, I don't know, it's got to be hard to kind of separate the I'm into God because I'm in Nashville versus I'm into God because I'm into God.
Right.
So, I mean, what's been your spiritual journey, man? I mean, did you grow up in a happy, clappy Jesus home that, you know, sang gospel music all the time and did the God stuff just kind of roll in later in your life? Was it always there? Do you know? I mean, how? Because I don't know. You know nothing about me, but I have struggled. Even though I've you know, was a pastor for 5 years, I have struggled royally with my faith, and I still don't get it. I just don't get it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I grew up in a home of believers. You know, my family were believers, but my parents were divorced when I was three, and. A lot of stuff happened and that was not a real consistent thing in my life early on. I mean, I knew, about God and I knew we were supposed to believe this and that, you know, and then I had some really amazing moments in my early teen years. I used to go to church camp with my cousins, out in southwestern Oklahoma and, around my aunt and uncle, I really saw how, you know, a family, you know, in my opinion, is supposed to function and their church, scene and going to church camp with them and really hearing the real story and being around people that were really trying to walk it, you know, and it made a big impact on me as a kid. And then I moved to Nashville a believer, but more, I feel like I was always just kind of the guy that had this altar call moment and I've got my fire insurance and I'm wearing my badge and, yeah, you know, yeah. Kumbaya, you know. But it wasn't until kind of where it was more like, okay, the gloves are off is, you know, kind of that period I was telling you about. I was like, all right, I know you're there, but, you know, I've really never... you know, it's never really been a relationship or, you know, like trying to, you know, walk it. It's always been like this more legalistic kind of thing, you know. Mm. Okay, God, bless my food. Bless my plane. Don't let this plane go down. Yeah. You know, it's kind of all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until I, dealt with all that in the late 90s, you know, losing my confidence and having vocal issues and being burnout and that it really caused me to look at who I am and you know, when all of those things get sort of stripped away, I think it becomes apparent that, you know, you can't do it all by yourself. And so that was really the first time I, you know, t- took the gloves off and went mano a mano and said, "Hey, you know, life really is really sucking right now. What, you know, are you going to help me or not?" It was like one of those kind of, it was like Bruce Almighty for me almost, you know. I felt like that. I really did feel like that, you know. And and he showed up, and I really had an authentic come to Jesus moment, you know, in the late 90s. And my life's never been the same since, you know. I'm not saying I've arrived, and I still have a lot of difficulty, you know. I've got a long way to go. And
that's what I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I still get, you know, mad, and we have our little bouts here and there, but I know that God loves me because I get to wake up and see these two little miracles every day, and I know that he loves me because my wife married me and I have these two kids. That's how I know he loves me, you know, and I know the stereotypical thing is to say because he died for my sins and all that, and I know that, and that's a reality, and that is the real miracle, but I see those practical things every day that remind me that, you know, man, I'm really fortunate, you know. I'm fortunate that I'm still here, and I know that he loves me because of these three individuals, you know.
Man, what a story. How weird is it that both you and Shania struggled with security and voice issue stuff? That's just bizarre.
I know, it's weird. I've tried on numerous occasions to reach out to her. I don't know anybody currently that's in her camp. I used to. I've tried to tweet her and hit her up in certain social media areas. I was actually at her big press conference about her Caesar's Palace show. It was at the Country Music Hall of Fame, and I was, you know, yards from her, but I was not able to talk to her. But a lot of people have told me that, you know, it would be really great for you guys to have a conversation, and so it is really weird. I mean, I find that really ironic, but I really relate. I really have a compassion for people that have had not only that issue, but just anything that's fear-based,
yeah.
You know, anybody that's dealt with, you know, huge increments of fear and post-traumatic. I mean, my right arm, I know this is so dramatic to say this, but my right hand is shaking as I'm talking about this stuff because it's real, you know.
Wow.
But I have a lot of sympathy for people that have any post-traumatic stress stuff, you know, military people that come home and don't know how to function, and people that have lost their voice or just their confidence, you know, any of those things. I really, really feel for people like that, you know.
Yeah. Well, so, dude, you are, you know, I know this is probably the most overused statement in the world, but I love the real deal about you, and everything I heard about you prior to this conversation is true. You are just one authentic cat. Brian White, Grammy-winning country recording artist. His website is brianwhite.com, Brian with a Y, and June 10th is when you want to giddy up on his latest CD, latest album. You know, I don't know how you're buying things these days, if it's digital or what it is, but his latest 8-track, folks, is coming out June 10th. Thanks, Brian. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Anytime.
Good to talk to you, buddy. Brian White on the Drew Marshall Show. Good to have him. Stay with us.
Maybe you've been thinking about advertising your organization on the radio, but don't really have the budget for a long-term marketing campaign? Well, what if we gave you a show? The Drew Marshall Show is currently offering an innovative advertising concept for the small business owner or charity. With web stats and listenership at an all-time high, Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show is offering you an opportunity to partner with us one show at a time. Consider sponsoring one show, and we'll introduce you to our listening audience for the day. Drew will mention your organization every hour during our 4-hour show, including a live phone interview. We'll also post your logo and website link on our website for an entire month. If you're thinking about promoting a special event, product, or upcoming sale, or if you just want to test the radio advertising waters without a huge investment, then consider becoming a one-day advertising partner with The Drew Marshall Show. Go to drewmarshall.ca for details or call Joy 1250 on 905-845-2821, extension 367. That's 905-845-2821, extension 367.